Many of us know Fort Boonesboro as the site where Daniel Boone and his fellow settlers fought back Native Americans, protecting the settlement and their people. But as Nancy O'Malley explains in her new book, Fort Boonesboro has so much more history. The book is Boonesboro Unearthed: Frontier Archaeology at a Revolutionary Fort. Joining me in the studio is archaeologist and author Nancy O'Malley. Nancy, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Wendy.
Nancy, your research began in 1987, so tell us a little bit about the project that got all this started.
Well, the short story is that I came to Kentucky in 1979. I'm not from here. And I got interested in the early settlement era of Kentucky's history. So I started working on a project on pioneer stations. I'd never heard of these before. Mm-hmm. And this culminated in a book called Stockading Up, which is actually, I'm currently in the process of revising, which will make a lot of people listening to this happy who know about it. But this made me become better known for studying this particular period, which archaeologists just hadn't taken much interest in before that. Because of that research, a man named Jim Kurz learned about me, and he decided that it would be interesting to look into Fort Boonesboro. And there's a longer story about that, but it's in the book, so I'm not going to tell it here. But anyway, he got in touch with me, and I was really intrigued with the idea because I, of course, was familiar with Fort Boonesboro. So we started this project together, and he was the one that really cobbled all the money that did the first part. And then after that, everything that did culminate in a report. And then after that, it went for like 25 years, and we didn't get back to the site until 2012. But in that intervening 25 years, I continued to do a lot of research, both on Boonesboro and on that early settlement era. So by the time I went back, I knew a whole lot more about the fort site than I'd known in 87. And from there, we had several years of more excavation. And finally, I decided I had enough information that I could write sort of my definitive book on it. And here we are.
You had mentioned earlier pioneer stations. What is a pioneer station?
A station was a defensive residence that generally was composed of more than one family. They were established during the Revolutionary War as a means of providing places of sanctuary and also places to live that you could defend against a Native American attack. Because, of course, Kentucky was settled in the middle of the Revolutionary War. It actually was settled just prior to it, and the settlement process continued through to the end of the war and even beyond the Revolutionary War. So there was a need for these defensive sites where people could live and stay in a protective
without having
situation.
To build an entire fort for that.
Right. And most of these were very small sites. They were cabins that often were connected by stockade. An author called them forts in miniature. Sometimes they were no more than a cabin that was just barricadable. You could put a bar on the door. You didn't really have any windows. Or if you had windows, they had interior shutters that you could bar. So they weren't defensible, you know, to a really big onslaught, but you could hole up in there and probably do pretty well because most of the Indian raids that we had here were short, swift, and all too often deadly. But at least if you were behind a fairly solid wall, then you had some chance of waiting them out and eventually they would leave. And that was true of the larger forts as well. But Bryan Station of Bryan Station Road fame is one of the stations. A very famous one, actually.
The Indian attacks that you talked about, that being shorter, that's what made the Great Siege of 1778 such a big deal because it lasted so much longer.
Yes, it was unusual for its length. It went for, depending on how you count the days, but at least 9 days of pretty sustained effort. And that was unprecedented. There were other times shorter sieges elsewhere and also Boonesboro. Boonesboro had one that lasted for a couple of days. But this siege, too, was unusual because of the tactics that they used. There was the attempt to tunnel from the river, and then they used some very traditional kinds of sort of siege tactics, the tunnel being one of them. They also tried to set the fort on fire, unsuccessfully, thankfully.
Because it was raining.
It was raining. Actually, all our rain and our crazy weather was the thing that really kind of turned the tide there. Because we were only talking about a few hundred people, maybe 60 men altogether. The mm-hmm. numbers are really hard to pin down. But and a bunch of women and children. Of course, the women were also very useful in this process because they were running bullets and loading guns for guys. And some of them, a couple of them probably, were even shooting occasionally. Mm-hmm. And then they had that crazy story about them. They had hats on and hats on sticks, and they were supposed to be parading back and forth, so to give the idea of better, higher numbers. I'm not sure I put that in the book, but I don't think I did. There was just some great stories that came out of that yeah. particular battle. And of course, the other interesting part of it was that it was Chief Blackfish who mm-hmm. led the entire group on the Indian side, and he had been Daniel Boone's adoptive father. So there was this kind of human personal element going on there too, because Daniel, as the adopted son of Chief Blackfish, had fled his captivity to come back and warn the fort. So there's some interesting human interest angles mm-hmm. to the siege as well that I found really fascinating.
I'm talking with archaeologist and author Nancy O'Malley about her recent book, Boonesboro Unearthed, Frontier Archaeology at a Revolutionary Fort. Nancy, your book is almost broken up into two parts, the first part being the history of the area of Kentucky before the Transylvania Purchase up until present day. And the second part is more along your archaeological findings and, you know, what you found when you went there and excavated. Can you tell me about the artifacts you found?
Sure. Before I get to that, let me just point out that one of the reasons that historical archaeologists do so much archival research is because we need to put our archaeological findings in context. Mm-hmm. So I felt it was really important to lay out all the historical context that produced these artifacts and these features. And also, it was important to know what happened after the site was abandoned, because things happen to sites because of other activities that take place on them or around them. And this particular site, Fort Boonesboro, was very much affected by later things that happened on the site. So that's why I went to all that trouble to lay out the entire history of the site. As to what we found, I've looked at several late 18th century defensible sites now, and so I kind of know what to expect. But it, I think, often a surprise to people what we do turn up. And one of the things that is a very common artifact that you wouldn't think would be that noteworthy, but in this context, it is, are hand-wrought nails. We found lots of hand-wrought nails. Mm-hmm. And if you go back and look in some of the literature, the secondary literature on this period, you will see people claiming that nobody ever used a nail to build anything on the frontier. And I'm here to tell you that that is not so.
You even have pictures in the book of these nails you had found.
I have plenty of nails, and everybody who could bring nails brought nails, I can tell you. And in fact, there was probably even some blacksmithing and production of nails.
And there were different types of nails that they used.
Different ones, but the ones we found were most commonly a similar size, about the size of, you know, the sort of standard construction nail you'd use today, except mm-hmm. that a wrought nail is handmade. It's not made of wire like our nails are today. But that was significant too, because we didn't find very many of the later cut nails, which helped me date the demise of that site, mm-hmm. Along with some other evidence. But the other thing that we found, the other types of things that we found, were the sorts of things you would find on any residential site, only we find them in very, very small numbers on sites like this. Personal items like sewing equipment, clothing parts, always lots of buttons, found a couple of pairs of scissors, straight pins, which are not used just for sewing, but also women would use them to attach parts of their clothing, like the bib on an apron to your shirt or a scarf that you would, a kerchief that you mm-hmm. would want to hold in place. Straight pins were also used for things like pinning documents together mm-hmm. as like a staple. So there were other uses for those. We found beads. My reenactor buddies just loved this because there was this controversy among the reenactors whether or not they could authentically wear beads. Mm-hmm. And so I was saying, well, we found them here, so yeah, you can. And we were even found a couple of seed beads, which are normally considered to be trade beads. But we know from a record that Daniel Boone had some beaded leggings. So there
which
was,
you talk about in
yeah,
your book as
I do
well.
Mention mm-hmm. that in the book. So there was sort of some trading back and forth. The Indians sort of didn't live sort of monolithically differently from the settlers. There was a lot of commonalities, actually, mm-hmm. Even in the midst of all the adversarial relationships that they had. We also found things like little sherds of plates and dishes, because the women would bring along some treasured teapot, as mm-hmm. we found a tiny little handle fragment from an English-style teapot, Wedgwood. We found a little bit of glass, not very much. Glass containers were very expensive to produce, and what people did, if they had anything in glass, like say you had a case spout bottle for liquor, you would just reuse it, and you would hang onto that and make sure you didn't break it and pass it along in your will sometimes. Mm-hmm. They actually are listed in probate inventories in that period. And then, of course, we found a fair amount of animal bone, which showed us what they were eating. There's a lot of talk about in the literature about what pioneers ate. It was largely a mixture of wild and domestic meat. Mm-hmm. Pork, mm-hmm. beef. They did have poultry. We did find eggshell, which is rare to find that. But we also found deer, bear, fish, turkey. So they were mixing it up mm-hmm. To make sure they had a good meat diet. And then they had also a similar mixture of domestic and wild plants that they were either raising or gathering.
So how would you find that out? How would you find out that they had been eating those plants or particular kinds?
We take soil samples. Mm-hmm. We found several features that clearly had been some kind of storage pit, and also several hearths, obviously, mm-hmm. that demarcated where the cabins were. And so we saved the soil from those, and we put them through a water flotation process in which it gets rid of the dirt and it saves the botanical remains and any kind of other thing like rocks and burnt clay, and there's mm-hmm. a whole raft of stuff that it produces. And then you very carefully, you hire someone to do this, which is what I did. You very carefully have someone pick through it and find the seeds and nutshell and all the other identifiable botanical remains. And this I go to a specialist for, as I do for the faunal material, the mm-hmm. animal bone. And Bruce Manzano did my faunal analysis, and Renee Bonsani did the botanical. And I was... So we found out some really great stuff there. Wow. And it tended to reinforce what we already knew, but it also, you know, showed a few new things that didn't necessarily get into the literature, particularly in terms of medicinal plants that they would have gathered in the wild.
Mm-hmm. You know, the way you wrote the book, and you said that you went to all the trouble to write the history at the beginning. You know, the way you wrote it, it's not like a history textbook at all. You created the story. You know, you wrote this a story of facts, but I found myself quickly being drawn into it and just turning the pages. And by the time that Daniel Boone had escaped Chief Blackfish, and you had written one line, and this one line really stuck out to me when you wrote, "The Kentucky frontier was on the front lines of the Western theater of the war, and Fort Boonesboro was a prime target." When I read that line, I knew what was going to come. I knew what was getting ready to happen, and I was excited. It got, you know, it was like, yes, we're about to go to battle here. Why was Fort Boonesboro so important? Why was it such an important feature during the Revolutionary War?
Well, it was one of only a handful of really large public forts. In 1778, we didn't even have a large fort at Lexington, although there was a settlement there. Mm-hmm. We had Fort Harrod, which had preceded, the settlement of which had preceded Boonesboro by barely a year. We had some settlements in Louisville. Mm-hmm. And then we had some larger stations like Logan's Station down in Stanford. It was in 79 when the population really started to increase here after the passage of a land law in Virginia. Prior to 79, there were not that many places mm-hmm. where people could come and stay safely, and Boonesboro was one of the main spots. And when you look at the archival literature, particularly if you go up and look at British and Canadian papers and things, the Indians were well aware of where these places were. So they knew where they had to focus their attention if they were going to do anything big. A lot of the raids that they came down, they would do them in small numbers generally, you know, maybe a dozen or a few dozen sometimes warriors. And they would just kind of hope to come upon something, you know, someone. They weren't always, I think, that meticulously planned. Maybe they had some information about a settlement that, you know, they were going to go look for. But a lot of times they came down to steal horses. And where you really ran into trouble is if you were away from your settlement. Mm-hmm. But if they wanted to come down and attack a place that had more people, then you had to go where they lived. And Fort Boonesboro was one of those places.
So, Nancy, where can your book be found for those who'd like to read it?
Well, my first place that I would suggest is the Fort Boonesboro Foundation website. Mm-hmm. I'm going to put a plug in for the foundation because this book wouldn't have probably gotten out without their financial help. And there's lots of moral support. And they are selling it on their website. But it's also available widely. It's on Amazon, and mm-hmm. The University Press website also sells it. And I'm not sure which outlets mm-hmm. are carrying it locally, but I would expect they'll make sure it's in Barnes & Noble. And I have several events planned that will be announced through the foundation, through the press, and other mm-hmm. means. So there's lots of opportunities, both to buy the book and even to get it signed if you want to.
Wonderful, wonderful. Nancy O'Malley, archaeologist and author of Boonesboro Unearthed, Frontier Archaeology at a Revolutionary Fort. Nancy, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
It's been a pleasure.